something about Narmon, which Narmon would just as soon not have his new emperor find out about. "You're clutching at straws, Corin," Doyle said very quietly from behind him, and Garvey's expression stiffened. "You know perfectly well that if it wasn't Caleb, it almost certainly was the Church." Windshare inhaled quickly, angrily, but Garvey didn't even twitch for several seconds. Then his shoulders slumped, and he nodded heavily. "You're right, Charles." His voice was barely audible, and he closed his eyes. "You're right. And if the men fighting against God act with honor, while the men who claim to be fighting for God do something like this, then what do you and I and Alec do?" August, Year of God, 893. 1. Prince Hector's Palace, City of Manchir, League of Coruscant.
"I hope you have some damned idea what we do next," the Earl of Anvil Rock said harshly.
He and Earl Tartarian sat in what had been Prince Hector's Privy Council Chamber, looking at one another across the table where they'd spent so many hours conferring with Hector. The western sky, visible through the chamber's window, was an angry sheet of beaten copper, streaked with fire-edged bands of cloud.
"Which," Tartarian thought, "is altogether too damned appropriate for words."
The 3 days since the murders of Hector and his son had been among the most exhausting of Tartarian's life. Probably the only man who was even more exhausted than he was the one who currently sat across the table from him. Together, they'd managed to maintain order in Coruscant's besieged capital, but how long they could continue to do that, and what was happening outside the city of Manchir, was more than either of them could say.
"If you want brilliant ideas, you've come to the wrong man, Rysel," Tartarian said frankly. "All I know for sure is that right now we're riding the Slash Lizard, and you know how well that worked out, according to the story."
Anvil Rock's mouth twitched in a brief smile, but it never touched his eyes, and he drew a deep breath.
"We have to decide what we're going to do about the succession," he said. "And we've got to decide what to do about Caleb's goddamned army, too."
"I'm afraid Caleb's army is the easy part," Tartarian replied. "There's not anything we can do about it, which really only leaves us one option where Caleb is concerned, doesn't it? It's not one either of us likes, but at least it has the virtue of a certain brutal simplicity."
"After the son of a bitch murdered Hector?" Anvil Rock half snarled.
"First," Tartarian said in a deliberately calm tone, "we don't have any proof Caleb was involved in that assassination at all."
"I know he said he wasn't," Anvil Rock interrupted. "That's exactly what he would say, though, isn't it? And if it wasn't him, who else was it?"
"I don't know who it was. That's my entire point."
Tartarian thought again about mentioning one unpleasant suspicion which had occurred to him, and decided again not to. Not directly, at any rate.
"It could have been Caleb, although exactly how he could have gotten his assassins through the siege lines is an interesting question. On the other hand, it could equally well have been someone trying to curry favor with Caleb, someone trying to force a surrender before the war did even greater damage to whatever his interests might have been. Or even someone who'd learned the prince was planning to negotiate with Caleb, and was determined to prevent him from reaching any sort of accommodation with Caris."
That last possibility was as close as he cared to come to suggesting that the assassins might have been temple loyalists, or even direct agents of the Church. From the unhappy flicker in Anvil Rock's eyes, the army commander had caught his implication.
"The one thing that strikes me about it from Caleb's viewpoint, though," Tartarian continued, is how incredibly stupid it would have been. Mind you, people do stupid things, especially when there's enough hatred involved, and God knows Caleb and the prince hated each other. But if it was Caleb, it was the first stupid thing he's done that I know of. And whether it was him or not, that doesn't change the fact that he's still got an army and a navy, and we don't. I hate to say it, Rysel, but we don't have a choice. In fact, with the prince gone, we've got even less of a choice than he had. Even if that's true, what makes you think the rest of the princedom would pay any attention to us? Anvil Rock asked bitterly. At the moment, who else can they pay attention to? With Philip out of the princedom, with Iris and Divan, you're the closest thing we've got to a first counselor. Not to mention the fact that the prince had named you as regent if anything happened to him. But he named me regent for young Hector. With him dead right along with the prince, I don't have anyone to be regent for. There's always Joel, Tartarian said very cautiously. No! Anvil Rock's flat palm cracked explosively on the council table's surface, and his exhausted face flushed with anger. Despite the glare in his eyes, Tartarian was glad to see the emotion, for more than one reason.
If I don't say it to you, Rysel, someone else will, he said after a moment.
If the prince had ever contemplated, even for a moment, that he and young Hector might both be killed, he wouldn't have sent Divan to Delphirac. But he did, and we're all stuck with the consequences of that.
Anvil Rock's jaw muscles ridged. For just a moment, he seemed to hover on the brink of lunging to his feet and storming out of the council chamber. But then he made himself sit back and draw another of those deep, steadying breaths, of which he seemed to require so many recently. Tartarian was right, and Anvil Rock knew it, which didn't make him like it one bit better. And not simply because of the invidious position in which it threatened to place him personally. The previous couple of generations had not been overgenerous where the House of Dakin's progeny was concerned. Prince Hector's grandfather, Prince Luke, had produced only two children, Hector's father, Franz, and his uncle, Alec. Prince Franz had produced only two children who'd lived to their majorities, Hector himself and his sister, Cheryl. And Alec Dakin had produced only a single daughter, Farah, Hector's first cousin. Both Hector and Cheryl had been rather more prolific than their parents. Hector had produced three children, and Cheryl had produced no fewer than five, and thereby hung Anvil Rock's problem, because Cheryl had married his own second cousin, Sir Jason Garvi, the Baron of Windhoek, which made her children Garvi's second cousins once removed. And, of course, made them Prince Hector's nieces and nephews. Under Coruscantian law, Prince Divan was his father's legal heir, following his older brother's murder. Neither he nor Tartarian doubted that Iris would have made a better ruler than her 9-year-old brother, especially under the current calamitous circumstances. But unlike Chisholm, Coruscantian law had established generations ago that a daughter could not inherit the throne. And the question, unfortunately, was moot at the present moment anyway, since neither Divan nor Iris was in Coruscant. Their first cousins, on the other hand, were, and young Joel Garvi, the current Baron Windhoek, stood next in the succession after Divan.
I know someone's going to argue that we ought to put Joel in Divan's place, Anvil Rock said after a moment. I can see some pretty forceful arguments in favor of doing just that. But whatever anyone else might suggest, I can't be a party to deciding to do it for a lot of reasons, including the fact that all of my oaths were sworn to Divan's father, not to Jason. And, he added more unwillingly, even if that weren't the case, Joel isn't up to the job, and you know it, Tarrell.
I don't know if anyone could be up to the job under the circumstances, Tartarian replied. On the other hand, I do know what you mean, he admitted. The good news is that I think Joel would say the same thing.
So do I, Anvil Rock said heavily. He's always done his best, but to be brutally honest, he makes a good baron. Tartarian nodded. The current Baron Windhoek was only 18, and he'd succeeded his father, and become his younger sibling's legal guardian, when both of his parents were killed in a coach accident 3 years before. Unlike Crown Prince Hector, he'd always tried as hard as he could to discharge the responsibilities of his birth. Yet his wit was no more than average, if that. As Anvil Rock had just said, he managed to meet his obligations to his barony, if only by dint of working doggedly at them. But he would really have been happier as a simple gentleman farmer, and the thought of ascending to the Coruscantian throne under any circumstances, far less the ones which currently obtained, must be terrifying to him. Assuming, of course, that the possibility had ever crossed his mind for a moment, which, even now, it very well might not have. A probability which only underscored how utterly unsuited to the throne he would prove. If they did place him on it anyway, he would be desperately unhappy. Tartarian could have lived with that, if he'd had to, in the best interests of Coruscant. Unfortunately, the one thing it most definitely would not be was in Coruscant's best interests. The amiable, hard-working, very likable young dullard would find himself the hopeless and helpless target of factional manipulation, with disastrous consequences for the princedom. His younger brother, Marak, at 14, would have been a far better choice. But he was the younger brother, and passing over Joel in his favor would only exacerbate what would inevitably become a ferocious succession dispute if Divan was set aside in anyone's favor in the first place.
If it's not Joel, then it has to be Divan, Tartarian said aloud, and that unmuzzles a slash lizard all its own.
Tell me about it, Anvil Rock said dryly.
There's no way James is going to send him back to Coruscant, Tartarian continued. Even if he were inclined to do that, there would have to be a legitimate question in his mind about Divan's safety. If Caleb did have the prince and young Hector assassinated, he certainly wouldn't hesitate to murder Divan as well. And whether Caleb was behind the prince's murder or not, James has to be aware of how valuable a card Divan's just become, especially given the fact that he's at war with Caleb, too. And if there were any possible way James might not notice it, Clinton and Trenaire damned well will.
Anvil Rock's expression was grim.
Exactly, Tartarian nodded. So, if we insist he's the legitimate prince of Coruscant, then we have to establish a legitimate regency in his name. And as you just pointed out, your writ of regency was for young Hector, not Divan. Which means getting the council to agree to making a 9-year-old boy, who's not even in the princedom, and who's likely to be seen as a valuable pawn by every ambitious politician in the world, Prince of Coruscant, and to name someone as his regent.
Wonderful. Anvil Rock leaned back, rubbing his face and eyes wearily.
To be honest, I don't think you and I have very much choice, Rysel, Tartarian said grimly. As you say, Joel would undoubtedly be a disaster on the throne, and we can't afford to fracture the succession any further than we can possibly avoid. And, unfortunately, the only two men I know whose loyalty to the prince and to Coruscant I trust, and who have the power to force a resolution of the entire question, are you and me.
I won't be party to any coups, Anvil Rock said flatly, lowering his hands from his face and meeting Tartarian's eyes levelly across the table. Once we open that door, once anyone opens that door, we set our feet on the road to outright civil war. A civil war with a Carizian occupation sitting right in the middle of it.
You're right, and I'm not suggesting any coups. Tartarian met those eyes without flinching. I'm an admiral, you're a general. Even if we managed to seize power, how would we manage to exercise it without driving the coach straight over the edge of the cliff? Neither of us is the politician Philip is, but he's out of the princedom. Without him to advise us, we need a substitute at least as good to keep us from making some sort of disastrous mistake, and I don't know another politician here in the princedom I'd trust. The good news, such as it is and what there is of it, is that Caleb's presence means the traditional political arrangements aren't going to apply anyway. Or do you think Caleb Armak is likely to leave any Coruscantian in a position to threaten his own plans?
Anvil Rock opened his mouth, then paused and closed it again.
Exactly, Tartarian said again, and produced a wintry smile. What we're really talking about here isn't seizing power. It's going to be a matter of making the best terms we can when we surrender power to Caleb. I'm sure at least some of our esteemed fellow nobles aren't going to see it that way. They're going to figure we're cutting some sort of deal with Caleb, but that's exactly what they'd be doing in our place. Which is why I say you're the only other man in a position to act whose loyalty I trust. No matter what we do, we're going to find ourselves with enemies coming at us from every direction, Anvil Rock said after a moment. The ones who think we've made some sort of arrangement with Caleb are going to be furious that they didn't have the opportunity to do it first. And the ones who recognize that we've surrendered to Caleb are going to blame us, and probably especially me, for the fact that Caleb kicked our arse in the first place.
And while you're enumerating all of the people who are going to be pissed off with us, Tartarian agreed with a grimace, let's not forget, in order of importance, our own temple loyalists, the church, and the group of four, especially the Grand Inquisitor.
Lovely. Trust me, Tartarian said very sincerely, if there were any way in the world I thought we could hand the responsibility for this off to someone else, I'd take it in a heartbeat. Unfortunately, we can't.
Well, technically, we could, Anvil Rock pointed out. There's a legal quorum of the council here in Manchir with us, you know. We could always let them decide what to do about it.
I can just see you doing that, Tartarian snorted. Actually, as you pointed out yourself a few minutes ago, we are going to have to assemble the quorum, if only so the two of us can lean on them to formally name Divan as prince.
Sure, and are you going to tell me that when we do assemble the quorum, you'd trust any of them with a broken-down draft dragon? The ones who wouldn't steal it or sell it to someone else would probably starve the poor critter to death.
You're probably being too kind to them, and no, I wouldn't trust them with a broken-down draft dragon.
So, we're in agreement, then?
Silence hovered in the wake of Tartarian's question. He could see the conflicting emotions behind Anvil Rock's exhausted face, and they were easy to recognize, since he shared them fully. The desire to avoid the responsibility, the shame of admitting military defeat, the bitter anger left by the assassination, and the lingering suspicion, whatever logic might say, that Caleb Armak had in fact ordered that double murder. The knowledge that whatever they decided, the two of them would be reviled by other men who hadn't had to make the same decisions, or whose own hopes for power had been dashed. And the awareness that it wouldn't matter to the group of four that they'd had no choice but to negotiate with the schismatics of Caris. There were far more reasons than Tartarian could count for the two of them to shirk the decisions which lay before them, and both of them knew it. And yet...
Yes,
Sir Rysel Garvai, the Earl of Anvil Rock, said heavily.
We're in agreement.
2. Prince Caleb's Headquarters Tent, Duchy of Manchir, League of Coruscant. Caleb Armagh rose as the Earls of Tartarian and Anvil Rock were escorted into his command tent.
Earl Anvil Rock and Earl Tartarian, Your Majesty, Lieutenant Austin said.
The two Coruscantians bowed stiffly, and Caleb returned the courtesy with a half-bow of his own.
My lords, the Emperor smiled very slightly and waved one hand at the other man who'd just risen from the table.
I believe you know General Garvai.
Father, Sir Corin Garvai said.
My lord.
He bowed to Tartarian, and his father held out his hand.
It's good to see you again, Corin, he said, although...
His own smile could have frozen water, even in Manchir.
I could wish it had been under other conditions.
The younger Garvai clasped his father's hand and nodded. Then Caleb cleared his throat quietly, and all three of the Coruscantians looked at him.
My lords, he said to them, I'm sure all of us wish we might have met under happier circumstances. Unfortunately, we haven't. Yet, whatever the circumstances, a host has certain duties. Please be seated. Allow me to offer you refreshment.
The others settled into the indicated chairs, and Caleb nodded to the single, tall, blue-eyed guardsman standing behind his own chair. Captain Athrawis came briefly to attention, then personally poured brandy into four glasses. He offered the first of them to Caleb, but the Emperor shook his head and indicated Anvil Rock, the senior of the three Coruscantians. The Earl accepted the glass, sipped politely, and nodded approval, and Merlin served the other two Coruscantians before placing the final glass in front of Caleb.
I realize, the Emperor said then, that the customary rules require you to compliment me on the quality of my brandy, for me to wave off the compliments with some modest disclaimer, and for the four of us to discuss the competing virtues of our national vintages, the local hunting, and the weather before getting down to our real business. With your indulgence, and in the interests of maintaining our mutual sanity, I propose that we consider that all of those polite conversational gambits are already behind us.
Earl Anvil Rock maintained an admirably impassive expression. Tartarian's lips might have twitched slightly, and Sir Corin raised his brandy glass again, sipping once more just a bit hastily.
As you wish, Your Majesty, Anvil Rock replied after a moment. In that case, however, I...
Pardon me, Caleb interrupted in a courteous tone, raising one hand. I realize that the request for this meeting came from you, but before we begin, there are a few things I would like to say. I assure you, he produced a crooked smile, that they aren't conversational gambits.
Of course, Your Majesty.
Anvil Rock settled back in his chair, his eyes wary, and Caleb leaned forward, resting his forearms on the table.
My lords, he said quietly, diplomacy... Unspoken understandings and polite lies no doubt have their place. In this instance, however, I think there's little point in any of us pretending that you, Earl Anvil Rock, and you, Earl Tartarian, must not at least suspect that I had a hand in the assassination of Prince Hector and his son. In your place, I certainly would, and I'm quite certain much of the rest of the world is going to automatically assume Prince Hector was murdered at my orders. And to be perfectly frank, given the history between my house and his, and the recent attack on Karis, I believe I would have been perfectly justified in having him killed.
Tartarian and Anvil Rock both tensed visibly, and Caleb smiled once more. This time, there was absolutely no humor in his expression, and his eyes met theirs levelly. They had no way of knowing that he had used his security comm to personally view the transmissions from the Snark which had spied upon their private meetings. Watching the holographic images had been like borrowing God's own eye. At the same time, the experience had helped him understand even better why not even Merlin could manage to keep track of everything that happened across the face of an entire planet. It had also suggested at least one possible way to ease Merlin's burden in that regard, although he hadn't brought it up yet. More to the immediate point, however, it meant he knew exactly what Tartarian and Anvil Rock had said to one another on this very subject. More than that, he'd seen their expressions, heard the tone of their voices. It was an advantage no other negotiator in Safehold's history had ever enjoyed, and he intended to use it. "I said I would have been justified in having him killed, my lords," he reminded them. "And I believe both of you are probably sufficiently aware of all the reasons why that would have been true. I didn't say it would have been wise of me to do that, however. And whatever justification I might have had for having him killed, I'm not in the practice of casually killing children." There hadn't been that many years between Caleb's age and that of Crown Prince Hector, but neither of the Coruscantian earls saw anything ironic in the Emperor's use of the word children. "Even setting aside all considerations of justification or justice, and ignoring the fact that the Crown Prince was killed as well, ordering Prince Hector's assassination would have been a particularly stupid thing for me to do under the circumstances. I fully realize that despite all of the reasons my subjects and I might have for thinking unkindly of him, his own subjects saw him in quite another light. Imprisoning him, or even having him executed after giving him time to make his peace with God, would have been one thing. They might not have cared for it, but they would have understood it, given all that had passed between us. Ordering him murdered would have been quite another thing, however, and I can think of nothing better calculated to harden any resentment and resistance here in Coruscant. Nor, for that matter," he looked directly into their eyes, "can I think of anything the group before could use against me more effectively? I assure you, gentlemen, that whatever my other failings might be, I'm neither blind nor stupid enough not to understand all of the dozens of reasons why assassinating Prince Hector would have been one of the worst things I could possibly have done." Neither Anvil Rock nor Tartarian said anything, but he thought he saw the memory of their own conversation replaying itself somewhere behind their eyes. And he saw their faces stiffen, especially Anvil Rock's, at his mention of the group of four. "That's an implication he doesn't want to think about," Caleb told himself. "From Tartarian's expression, though, it's one he's already been thinking about. Coruscant has been Karis's enemy for the better part of 30 years, my lords," he continued. "While I realize you and I are inevitably going to have different perspectives on that enmity, I believe simple honesty would compel you to admit that up until my own current visit to Coruscant, virtually all of the aggression in our relationship originated in Mancheer, not in Talisburg. I have no wish or desire to debate the causes for that, or to allocate blame. What I do desire, however, and what I intend to accomplish, is to put an end to the danger to Karis which Coruscant represents. And, gentlemen, I intend to put an end to it forever." His voice was darker, harder, with the final sentence, and he let silence linger for several heartbeats before he resumed. "I see no need for any of us to recapitulate all that's happened since the group before offered to finance and broker Prince Hector's attack on Karis. I know, however, and I'm sure both of you recognize, that Clinton and Trinair never saw Hector as anything more than a knife they might use to cut Karis's throat. I assure you, if Coruscant had indeed been able to take Karis's place as a mercantile power, or build a true Coruscantian empire as Hector wished,
the group of four would eventually have meted out the same fate to Coruscant. Corrupt men don't change, and in their eyes, it would have been a simple matter of one threat to their power being replaced by another. What never occurred to the group of four was that their plan to destroy Karis might not succeed. Unfortunately for them, it didn't, and the nature of the threat we represent to their power changed drastically as a result. If we survive, we prove that someone can defy the greed and demands of venal men who abuse the authority of God. And because that's true, they have no choice but to destroy us utterly. They may cloak that fact in the rhetoric of religion and appeal passionately to the will of the God whose laws they violate every day, but it remains true. And because it does, I cannot permit Coruscant to be used as a weapon against us yet again. I tell you this at the outset because I refuse to attempt to deceive you. Coruscant, whether willingly or not, will become part of the Carisian Empire. I can neither permit nor settle for anything short of that, for reasons which must be obvious to both of you. What remains to be settled are the conditions and circumstances under which that will be accomplished. Obviously, the two of you want to obtain the best possible terms for Prince Hector's subjects. Equally obviously, I have no desire to find myself embroiled in an unending succession of local rebellions against the imperial authority here in Coruscant. From the perspective of self-interest, if nothing else, then, it behooves me to impose the least punitive terms I can, while providing sufficient security for Coruscant's incorporation into the Empire. That, by the way, is probably the most compelling single reason why I would have avoided assassinating Prince Hector. To be honest, I had no intention of leaving him on his throne for several reasons, but his death, especially the circumstances under which he was killed, is inevitably going to provide a natural rallying point for the very rebellions and resistance I most want to avoid. His reasonable tone was having an effect, he saw. Neither Anvil Rock nor Tartarian could have liked what they were hearing, but it was obvious that they'd expected a much harsher attitude out of him. From both of our perspectives, the perfectly understandable anger Prince Hector's murder is going to provoke is an unfortunate thing, he continued. The fact that I recognize the justification it provides for potential resistance to Carisian authority also means I must insist upon terms which are going to be more severe and restrictive than might otherwise have been the case. Resistance would always have been likely. Now, unfortunately, I suspect that it's inevitable, and that it may well be both more severe and more widespread than it would have been otherwise. That being the case, I have no choice but to take steps which will permit me to deal with it when it arises. That will have consequences for you individually and for Coruscant's nobility and commoners alike. I regret that, but I can't change it. I also recognize the precarious position in which the two of you find yourselves, the potential for factional warfare in the event of a contested succession, and all of the other intensely destabilizing consequences Prince Hector's murder has created. Undoubtedly, the terms the two of you can accept, and even more importantly, convince or compel the other great nobles of Coruscant to accept, are also going to be affected by the assassination. I recognize that as well, and I will bear it in mind in any discussions between us. Nonetheless, any terms at which we may finally arrive will be my terms. I can settle for nothing less, and to be brutally frank, your military position entitles you to demand nothing more. He paused once again, allowing his words to settle fully, then leaned back in his own chair, still regarding them across the table. There's a reason I'm speaking with you directly, without bevies of advisers and without screens of ambassadors. I want there to be no misunderstandings, no gray areas. And I want you to know, and to be able to tell anyone who asks that you spoke directly to me. That whatever terms are ultimately offered to Coruscant are my terms. That if I will accept nothing less, I also will demand nothing more after the fact.
I appreciate your candor, Your Majesty, Anvil Rock said after a moment. I won't pretend I've enjoyed hearing everything you had to say, because I haven't. Nor, while I can understand and appreciate your position, do I feel any great temptation to sacrifice Coruscant's interests, or those of Prince Divan, to those of Karis. Nonetheless, I can't dispute your analysis of the current military situation, either. And whether or not you were involved in Prince Hector and Crown Prince Hector's murders, your analysis of the internal consequences to the princedom closely parallels Earl Tartarian's and my own view of them. Neither of us wants a situation in which armed resistance to Carizian rule, or even conflict between our own internal factions, results in punitive Carizian measures against Prince Divan's subjects.
He'd watched Caleb's expression carefully while he spoke, and now the Emperor smiled slightly.
I notice that you just referred to Prince Divan, my lord, he observed.
He is Prince Hector's legitimate heir, Anvil Rock pointed out.
True, Caleb agreed. Unfortunately, he isn't in the princedom at the moment, is he?
Both Coruscantian earls stiffened, and Caleb shrugged.
I realize that isn't common knowledge, even in the palace, gentlemen. Nonetheless, my agents and I have become aware of his absence, and of the absence of Princess Iris. In fact, I rather think one of my cruisers came very close to snapping the two of them up. Tell me, am I correct in suspecting that the Harchongi's galleon Wing, which for some peculiar reason was carrying a cargo of Carizian farm equipment from Karis to Shui right through the middle of our blockade of Coruscant, was actually carrying a rather more valuable cargo at the same time?
This time the Coruscantian's alarm was obvious, and Caleb shook his head.
My lords, while it pains me to admit that my navy isn't actually infallible, this time your efforts succeeded quite nicely, and we sent Wing on her way with our blessing.
He grimaced, but there was a slight twinkle in his eyes as well.
Certain of my other sources have confirmed Princess Iris's and Prince Divan's absence from Coruscant, however, and an examination of the report from Dawn Star's captain indicates the presence of three passengers aboard the mysterious Wing. I also note Earl Corris's absence from our meeting today, and I rather doubt the two of you would have simply absent-mindedly left him behind. And finally, if I'd been Prince Hector, and I'd decided to send my daughter and my younger son to safety, I can think of very few of my counselors to whom I would have felt comfortable entrusting them. In fact, I can think of only three or four, and two of them are sitting on your side of the table this morning. That suggests to my powerful intellect that the merchant factor and his two children shown on Wing's manifest were in fact Earl Corris, Princess Iris, and Prince Divan.
Tartarian and Anvil Rock looked at one another. Then Tartarian turned back to Caleb.
Since there's no point in pretending otherwise, in the long run, I suppose we may as well admit that you're correct, Your Majesty.
I thought as much, Caleb nodded. And in answer to the question you haven't asked, my lord, I would assume all three of them reached their destination safely. Obviously no one can guarantee the vagaries of wind or weather. You, as an admiral, will know that as well as I do. But your little ruse completely fooled the only one of my cruisers to actually intercept Wing, for which I compliment you. Although it does rather complicate both of our problems at the moment, doesn't it?
In fact, Caleb knew that Iris and Divan had reached Shui Bay without further incident.
I believe you could say it does represent at least a slight complication, Tartarian replied wryly.
It could hardly be otherwise, Caleb agreed. And from your choice of words, my lord, he looked at Anvil Rock, It seems evident you and Earl Tartarian, and I would assume the Council, have agreed to acknowledge Divan as Prince of Coruscant despite his absence, and despite any other potential contenders for the crown.
We have, Anvil Rock said shortly.
I think that was probably your wisest choice under the circumstances, Caleb said. On the other hand, it will undoubtedly create several difficulties. I'll be frank, my lords. Given Karis's relations with Coruscant over the years, the notion of leaving any member of Prince Hector's house on the Coruscantian throne, even as a vassal of the Carizian Empire, scarcely appeals to me. The notion of having the heir to the throne outside the princedom, and, forgive me, but we all know this is true, in a position to be used as a tool against Karis by our enemies, is even less attractive.
However attractive or unattractive it may be, Your Majesty, Earl Tartarian and I have neither the right nor the desire to depose our legitimate prince.
And I see you intend to be stubborn about that.
Caleb's brief smile deprived his words of most of their sting.
We do, Your Majesty,
Anvil Rock replied unflinchingly.
This may surprise you, my lord, but I not only respect your integrity, but in many ways I agree with your decision as well.
Despite himself, Anvil Rock's eyebrows rose slightly, and Caleb chuckled harshly.
Don't mistake me, my lord. Agreeing with you isn't the same thing as liking the situation. Nonetheless, creating a succession dispute would serve neither of us at this time, which means I'm prepared to recognize young Divan as Coruscant's legitimate prince and as Duke of Manchir.
Both Coruscantians' body language seemed to relax slightly, but Caleb wasn't quite finished yet.
Precisely what will ultimately become of Divan's claim to the crown remains to be seen. If he wishes to retain it, or for that matter his duchy, he will be required to swear fealty to me and to Empress Charlian, which will also hold true for every other member of the Coruscantian nobility. And I will not confirm him in any of his dignities so long as he stands upon any other realm's soil. I won't deprive him of them, but neither will I confirm them until I can be certain he's his own man, and not under the control of anyone else. Until such time as I can be certain of that, his duchy will be administered for him by someone of my own choice. I would prefer for that someone to be a Coruscantian rather than a foreigner imposed upon Manchir, and I would appreciate your suggestions for an appropriate steward.
Anvil Rock and Tartarian looked at one another again. Neither of them spoke, however, and they turned back to Caleb.
What precisely do you require of Coruscant, Your Majesty?
Anvil Rock asked bluntly.
I think I've already laid out my essential points, my lord. Specifically, I will require that Coruscant acknowledge Carizian sovereignty, and that all members of the Coruscantian nobility swear fealty individually to the Carizian crown. I will require the cooperation of your own parliament and your own law masters in integrating Coruscantian and Carizian law. I will require formal Coruscantian recognition of the dissolution of the League of Coruscant and recognition of Zebediah's already accomplished permanent integration into the Empire as a separate province. I will appoint a governor for Coruscant, acting in the names of myself and Empress Charlian and supported by a Carizian garrison. All Coruscantian warships will be surrendered and integrated into the Imperial Carizian Navy, and all Coruscantian army units will be disbanded. And I will insist, for reasons I'm sure you'll both understand, upon severely limiting the number of armed retainers any Coruscantian noble is permitted to retain.
The Coruscantians' faces had tightened again while he spoke, but he continued in that same calm, measured tone.
In return, I will guarantee the protection of the persons and property of Coruscantian subjects. There will be no general seizure of private property, and the property of the crown will be respected, although it will also be integrated into the imperial structure. All of the rights of Carizian subjects will be extended to any Coruscandian who swears fealty and faith to the Empire, and Coruscandians will be permitted to serve in the Carizian military if they so desire.
And the Church, Your Majesty? Tartarian asked softly.
And the Church, my lord? Caleb's voice was almost as soft as Tartarian's, and his smile was unpleasant. The Church of Carus follows the Crown of Carus.
Which means precisely what, Your Majesty?
Anvilroch asked, his voice harsher than it had been.
Which means the Church's bishops and serving clergy in Coruscant will be required to affirm their loyalty to the Church of Carus, and to acknowledge Archbishop Michael as the primate of that church,
Caleb replied flatly.
Any bishop or priest who cannot, in good conscience, make that affirmation and acknowledgement will be deprived of his office. He will not be imprisoned for his refusal, nor will he be forced into exile or deprived of his priest's cap. As Archbishop Michael has agreed, a priest is a priest forever, and despite the group of four's accusations, we have no desire to punish or victimize anyone simply because he cannot in good conscience agree with the position and organization of the Church of Carus. We will punish any treasonous acts, regardless of their justification, and regardless of who the traitors may be. But there will be no arbitrary arrests or imprisonment.
Many of our people will reject your right to dictate terms to Mother Church, however reasonably you may dress them up, Your Majesty,
Anvilroch said warningly.
For themselves, as individuals, they have every right to do so, Caleb said unflinchingly. If they step beyond matters of personal conscience into open defiance of the law which binds all men, or into organized resistance to the crown, then they become criminals, and they will be treated as such. Although, his eyes became harder than brown agate, I would recommend to their consideration the fact that Archbishop Michael has specifically rejected the teachings of the Book of Schuler, dealing with the appropriate punishment for heresy. Whatever the group of four may choose to do, the Church of Carus will not be responsible for atrocities like those inflicted upon Archbishop Eric. Nor will the Carizian Empire burn innocent cities or murder, rape, and terrorize their citizens, as the group of four proposed to do to Carus. Anvilroch tried to meet those hard brown eyes. After a moment, his own fell.
For what it's worth, my lords, Caleb said after a few moments, his voice rather lighter than it had been.
You can console yourself with the knowledge that Empress Charlian and myself remain under Grand Vicar Eric's writ of excommunication. Theoretically, I suppose, that means any oath you may swear to us is non-binding in the eyes of Mother Church. Or perhaps I should say the Council of Vicars and the Group of Four. Mind you, I intend to enforce any oaths you may swear exactly as if they were binding, but if it helps you or any of Coruscant's other nobles where your consciences are concerned...
He shrugged.
Your Majesty, we...
Anvilroch began just a bit sharply, but Caleb shook his head.
Forgive me, my lord, he interrupted. I didn't mean to sound as if I were making light of the situation, nor would I for a moment impugn the personal honor of you or Earl Tartarian. On the other hand, whether we wish to acknowledge the point or not, all of us know someone in Coruscant is going to take precisely that view in order to justify active resistance to the Empire. It's going to happen, my lords, and all of us know it. When it happens, I will do all in my power to avoid overreactions. But there will be consequences for those responsible, and those consequences will be severe. I have no more choice in that regard than any other secular ruler, however those involved may choose to justify their actions. I won't attempt to deceive you on that point, nor would you believe me if I did.
Anvil Rock looked at him for a moment, then nodded with genuine, if perhaps grudging, respect.
"At any rate, my lords," Caleb said more briskly, "I believe we all understand both sides' beginning positions. As I say, my terms and requirements are essentially simple, although I'm not so naive as to believe that giving effect to them won't be complicated, difficult, and unfortunately quite possibly accompanied by additional bloodshed. I would suggest at this time that you return to Manchir to discuss them with the other members of the council. Unless you disagree, I would recommend we meet again tomorrow, when you can give me the sense of the council's response, and we can continue these discussions, if that should be the council's decision. In the meantime, the truce between our two armies will continue."
"I believe that sounds reasonable, Your Majesty," Anvil Rock agreed gravely,
although he must have recognized as well as Caleb that ultimately the council had no option other than to accept Caleb's terms. And, Caleb suspected, whether Anvil Rock cared to admit it or not, he and Tartarian had to recognize that Caleb's demands were not simply reasonable, but minimal under the circumstances.
"Before you return to the city, however," the Emperor said, "I hope you'll do me the honor of dining with me and my own senior officers. I've arranged for a certain of our guests to join us at table," he added. And if his smile was small, it was also warmer than any which had yet been exchanged, as he nodded sideways at Sir Corin.
"Your Majesty," Anvil Rock said with a smile of his own, "the honor will be ours."
3. Royal Palace, City of Chiraeth, Kingdom of Chisholm. Empress Charlian looked around the small, familiar council chamber. She'd gotten a lot accomplished in this chamber over the years, she thought, and she'd never before been away from it for so long either. It was 1 year and 2 months to the day since she'd left Chisholm to marry Caleb Armagh, and there were times when she found it impossible to believe that so much had happened in so short a time. She crossed to the open window, put her hands on the sill, and looked out it, and her eyes softened with memory. It was true, absence made one see familiar things through fresh, new eyes, she thought, and savored the vista of hills, roofs, and trees. Beyond them she could just see the living blue marble of Cherry Bay, and the air was cool, not quite crisp, as if to warn her Chisholm's autumn was on its way. No doubt it seemed even cooler to her after her long stay in Caris, and she shivered inside as she gazed at leaves hovering on the brink of seasonal change and thought about the approaching winter. If she thought Caris had made her sensitive to this coolness, winter was going to be icy indeed. Yet even as she thought that, she realized there was something about the idea of winter that seemed almost comforting, a part of the life she'd always known, and her shiver turned into a smile as she thought about the ways in which this winter was going to be different. "And how much warmer your bed's going to be, you mean," she told herself, and chuckled. "You don't know how much I've missed hearing you do that," a voice said behind her, and she turned with a smile. Her mother smiled back, then crossed to seat herself at the conference table. Baron Green Mountain got there before she did, and pulled the chair out for her, and she looked up at him over her shoulder as she pushed it back closer to the table once she was seated. "Thank you, Marak," she said.
"You're welcome, Your Majesty."
He bowed to her with a smile, and Charlian's eyes narrowed in sudden speculation. Green Mountain's wife of more than 30 years had died 3 years ago, and Queen Mother Alana had been a widow for almost 13 years. They'd known each other literally since childhood, and they'd always been close, even before King Salis's death. Since then, they'd worked with one another, and with her, as political allies who relied upon one another absolutely, and the Empress suddenly wondered how she'd managed to miss the other ways in which they'd grown steadily closer.
I wonder if...
She cut that thought off in a hurry, mostly because it was none of her business, as long as they were discreet enough to keep their relationship from becoming a political issue, but also because she'd thought of them as Mother and Uncle Marak for so long that thinking of them any other way seemed obscurely wrong somehow.
How much you've missed me doing what, Mother? She asked now, innocently.
Laughing, Queen Mother Alana said simply. Of course, I've missed hearing you giggle even more. Charlene grinned and shook her head, then turned her back firmly on the window and took her own place at the table.
I've missed you too, Mother.
And you, Marak, she said, her expression more serious.
The feeling is mutual, Green Mountain told her. And not just because we've got such a stack of documents waiting for you.
Of course, it was his turn to glance somewhat pointedly at the window.
We'd rather expected you home some time ago.
I know, she said repentantly.
It was just one thing after another, and Caleb and I both thought.
Darling, we all know what you and Caleb thought. For that matter, we agreed with you,
Alana said, reaching out to lay a slim hand on her daughter's forearm.
I won't pretend I didn't resent the decision that kept you there so much longer. Until I met Caleb on his way through to Coruscant, that is.
She smiled warmly at her daughter and rolled her eyes.
Such a delicious young man. You managed to land quite a catch with that one, Charlie.
If her object had been to listen to her daughter's giggle, she succeeded admirably, and Charlene shook her head at her.
I can't disagree with any of that, Mother, the Empress said. On the other hand, you might want to think about the fact that he's made more visits to Tirith over the last, half year or so than he has to Telesburg. Of course he has. That's how I know your decision to stay in Telesburg was one of state, based on cold political calculation and your sense of duty, my dear. Given how tasty he is, that's the only conceivable reason you haven't been right here all that time.
I'm glad you appreciate the sacrifices I've been willing to make.
We certainly do, the Queen Mother said rather more seriously. And the fact that we may have agreed with your decision doesn't mean we didn't miss you.
If only I could be in two places at one time, Charlene sighed.
If you could, life would be a lot simpler, Green Mountain agreed. Since you can't, we'll just have to do the best we can, won't we?
And if I haven't mentioned this before, I want you to know how thankful I am that I have the two of you to help do that, Charlene said with utter sincerity.
I believe you have mentioned it a time or two, he said.
Possibly even more often than that, the Queen Mother added. I'd have to check my diary to be certain, of course.
Good, Charlene smiled.
My mother raised me to thank people whenever they did me little favors, like, running my kingdom for a year while I go gallivanting off to get married.
Green Mountain laughed, but the skin around Alana's eyes tightened.
It wasn't the getting married that worried me, dear. Not at least after we met Caleb.
She tried to keep her voice light, but she failed, and it was Charlene's turn to touch her arm with a comforting hand.
Mother, I can't begin to tell you how sorry I am, she said quietly. Don't be silly, Alana said.
The briskness she put into her voice was belied by the unshed tears glistening in her eyes, and she straightened in her chair and drew a deep breath.
Bertram always made his own decisions. You know that if anyone does. He made that one just like all the others, and no one else is responsible for its consequences. I only thank God that that monster Halcombe didn't succeed.
You can thank Edward and the rest of my guards for that, Mother, Charlene said somberly.
Without them...
She let her voice trail off, shaking her head, and Green Mountain nodded.
I already have. Thanked Edward, I mean, he told her.
I offered him a more substantial token of my gratitude as well. He turned it down.
Politely, I hope.
Yes, Your Majesty. Green Mountain smiled at her. He was very polite, in fact.
Good, Charlian said again, then leaned back in her chair